Look at the distortion in the air in front of you. See it fold and ripple, the way the light glistens off something that should not be there. Can you catch a glimpse of what is on the other side? It's called a wind door, and will take you to places both like and unlike our world. This one will take you to the 10 worlds of New Century, as written by Alex Shaw. Come with us on a journey through the wind door. Another episode of Through the Wind Door. This is going to be my and Toby's final journey into the world of Let Them Go, but obviously this is only the beginning of our journey into New Century, as this caps off the prequel to the entire story. Well, not the entire story, but the story thus far of New Century and the 10 worlds of it. As mentioned last episode, our topic list is going to work a little differently from previous. Instead of immediately diving back in and discussing every little thing of significance now that all listeners have the full context, we're going to pull out and look at this story through the broader lens of Gothic genre. Mind, we are both novices. Toby is a film student working on his PhD, but this isn't his focus of study. And I never graduated college. I have inhaled fiction from most of the formats out there, but Gothic is not my forte. Fortunately, Alex and Sharon love Gothic, so I let them be my guide. First, listening to their shows on Phantom of the Opera and Crimson Peak, the latter of which I have now seen and have a much greater appreciation of. And last night I watched one of the apparently seminal works in more cerebral horror called Don't Look Now, which apparently has I didn't know this until looking further into it myself, because the movie, it's a different kind of storytelling. There is nonlinear elements in there as well, but it's partly because of the supernatural that plays into it. It's termed as a psychic thriller, but when I took a look at the Wikipedia and did a little research on that, one of the things that I found out was that it's meant to be based off of the idea of the Gothic ghost story. We'll be throwing some terms at you, we'll be showing off a little bit and trying to compare where Let Them Go fits into Gothic genre, but also where it subverts it a lot. And toward the end, I'd like to present something that I came up with just a couple of days ago myself as I was pondering all of this. I mentioned all the way back in episode 2 that one of my favorite mythological archetypes was that of the triple goddess, and I'll briefly want to revisit some of that later in the podcast. But as I was writing up the topic list for our final episode, there was a different archetypal story that came to mind that I think fits even better for this particular narrative arc, as well as this particular genre. But let's not jump to the end. Let's first give a modest definition and deconstruction of Gothic. There are a number of different things that tend to denote the aspects of what Gothic literature is, whether you're talking about Gothic romance or Gothic horror, or in many cases, stories that mesh the two of them together. Toby, what would you say is one of the major components of Gothic that fits into Let Them Go?
So the first thing that comes to mind for me, and I think for different people, different aspects of defining characteristics of the Gothic genre will come to mind, is the one that is front and center. It's the thing that you go, well, if you're thinking of writing a Gothic genre, then you've got to have blank. I think everyone will have a different answer to that. But for me, it's very much about the setting. And I think that quite often these Gothic texts will go for sprawling landscapes, things like in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the sort of vast open landscapes as Dr. Frankenstein pursues his creature are very entangled with that. And that's the sort of natural side of things. But on the man-made side of things, you have buildings which have this sense of the grand and the ancestral. There'll often be estates, things like castles or manor houses, which are so big that they tend to swallow up the people who go there, the main characters. So even before anything threatening actually happens, you already feel threatened just going there. And in Let Them Go, that definitely happens. Rebecca feels uneasy and hesitant to go to Ravenwood. And even though there's a lot of personal reasons about it, and I think in some Gothic stories, the ominous Gothic setting is as foreboding as it is because the main character is unfamiliar with it, and so there's this sense of hidden history there. It's like in Dracula, and I forget the name of the character who goes to Count Dracula's castle at the start.
Jonathan Harker, who, like Dawson, is also a solicitor.
Picture that I must go this far and no further. He gets out of the stagecoach and he goes there. It's unfamiliar territory, and it is the place where monsters reside and hidden secrets are. For us, I think it's a case where the main character is aware of a lot of the history, but the audience isn't, at least to begin with. We're on a first watch through. I think that I've touched on it a bit through this initial rambling of mine, but I think the Gothic setting works as well as it does for me because it really does tie in the sense of the hidden secrets, and that's where ghosts come in. They will be tied to this place because there is a sense of history here. That's why they're often castles or manor houses, because it would be difficult, but I would be interested to see a Gothic story being told in a very modern building. It just doesn't feel like it would fit. And it's because you need to have a sense that the building is almost like a ghost itself, that it is something old and falling apart. A particular Gothic text that we'll be bringing up again and again throughout this podcast is Crimson Peak, and how in that story, the building is really decaying. It is quite literally bleeding from the cracks. And in this one, there's a feeling of dust and rust. And even though someone is living here, you get the sense that she's living the sort of ghost of the life she knew before. This doesn't feel like a well-maintained house. And it's because these buildings are often ridiculously too big. They can't be managed by one person. And so it feels like the building is going to swallow them up whole. I've gone on rambles throughout this whole thing, but if I can sort of bring it back to one specific point, I think that what Let Them Go is about is so much of the story takes place at Ravenwood because it is where a lot of the trauma for Rebecca is centered on, and because it's a family home and a lot of her trauma is to do with her family and the people close to her. So being in this one place, which is simultaneously really vast, but also really intimate because she's in one place trapped there with people, some of whom have caused her great pain in the past, even if they didn't mean to. So even though it's sprawling, it's also suffocating. And I think that that's what these Gothic locales can tend to do very well. They incite introspection in the characters by confronting them with spaces that resemble their inner turmoil and force that conflict to come pouring out. How do you think Ravenwood establishes a lot of the tone of the story?
Well, you've covered most of it, but you brought up a lot of other things along the way.
Sorry for that.
No, it's perfectly okay. You bring up Bram Stoker's Dracula, which was a bit of a duh moment for me, and that I hadn't immediately thought of it when considering classic Gothic fiction. I've never read the original novel, nor seen end-to-end any of its incarnations on the big screen. The only reason I know the story is due to the fact that I read an abridged graphic novel version of it. In that story, the setting would appear to be centered on the castle that Count Dracula lives in the Carpathian Mountains, and it probably is an important setting because it frames Dracula and his story. I wouldn't necessarily associate it as being it's like a character in the story, but it's not the same as Ravenwood is to Let Them Go or Allerdale Hall is to Crimson Peak. And I say this to not try and discount Dracula in any way, but on rereading a summary of the novel to confirm, most of the story doesn't take place in the castle at all, just the beginning and a tiny part of the end. Allerdale Hall and Ravenwood, by comparison, are the location where most of the story takes place. If we take away the timeline and respected ages of the edifices, they do serve the same purpose. All three are meant to invoke a dark and gloomy setting, the decay of years, decades, and centuries. They are supposed to reflect the tenor of their owners, and the weight of the crimes and or tragedies that have befallen there. They are genius loci in all but apotheosis. In the case of Ravenwood, which, you know, let's be frank here, it's called Ravenwoods, which immediately invokes Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, you know, the way that Amanda brings it into the story was specifically referring to the gibbets beside the side of the road where Hyman and other thieves were hung up as deterrents to other people that would break the law and such like.
And it worked, because now there's no such thing as crime.
The point is that it's when you call something Ravenwood, it's hard to not be invoking one of the more intense Gothic writers that most people are familiar with. Pit and the Pendulum, Cask of Amontillado, you know, all of that stuff. Heck, just his poem, The Raven, which is the thing that brought him to stirring success before he did anything else.
An oft-quoted piece.
Yes, oft-quoted piece. Although, to be perfectly honest, I don't remember now if The Raven was his first work. I just know it as being one of his most successful works. Originally in our conversation, we circled back to Crimson Peak, but I decided to cut that portion in the edit. But the gist is that both Toby and myself recommend highly that Crimson Peak is a movie worth your time, and that it should also be paired with the School of Movies podcast for a proper deconstruction of both Gothic themes and Guillermo del Toro's expert direction and aesthetic sensibilities. We'll try not to talk too much about it further and risk spoiling it for the uninitiated. The point that I want to make is that Ravenwood stands out from these other examples. Its components are not just Cleo and Matthew, or even the whole Wolverton family. Cleo's life in the house is the baseline, but everything else is what Rebecca brings with her. Only some of the ghosts she faces are even associated with the house. All of them are associated with her. Matthew doesn't show up as a ghost at all, because he was almost a non-entity where Rebecca is concerned. Ravenwood is haunted for Rebecca, because it is where her story and descent began. For her, and for us. Amanda, meanwhile, managed to escape that darkness, which is why it isn't a haunted place to her. As I recall, she talks with Rafe about how she loves this old house, even after everything that's happened here.
Exactly. She is very enamored with the Gothic side of it, so when the ending does come and Rebecca leaves, it is almost fitting, it is fitting that Amanda stays, and whether she actually would be a Bargus that just patrols Ravenwood, we don't know, but the point is that there is something about this setting which does make it feel as if she has blended in with it by the end of the story, whereas for Rebecca, the place is somewhere for her to come back from, which will tie into an idea that you did a lot of digging into, which is I need to look up the specific term because it is one I was not familiar with before, but it's the catabasis.
Oh yes.
Yes. Walk us through this one?
We'll get to that in a little bit because that's my ending theme. No, I want to delve a little bit more into some of the Gothic tropes first, because while I think we both definitely agree that the significance of the setting is very much an element of Gothic fiction, just from looking at a list of the things that famous Gothic horror or Gothic romance includes, Let Them Go subverts a lot of these tropes. And I feel like that may be part of why I enjoy this book as much as I do. If there was a specific barrier to getting into those kinds of stories, it would primarily be not the genre, but the writing style. Many of the authors that pioneered the genre, Mary Shelley, Poe, the Brontes, Austin Stoker, Stevenson, I likely tried to read their stuff during my formative years and found them impenetrable. There's a famous quote by Mark Twain, of all people, that a classic is something that everyone wants to have read and nobody wants to read. During the time of my life when I read the most, those stories did not intrigue me. At least not in their original format. I mentioned briefly before about a collection of classic novels that had been turned into a graphic novel format more accessible to kids. And that's why I know the broad strokes of many classic stories that include Frankenstein and Jekyll and Hyde and Dracula. But here's the crux. I also didn't know anything about genre back then. There were merely stories I liked and stories I didn't. And by and large, those that would qualify as gothic didn't resonate. There was one author that was the exception, John Bellairs. I devoured his YA books as a kid primarily because he wrote in an accessible manner to my young mind. I didn't have to decipher anything, and it was dialogue-focused rather than descriptive detail-focused, which was and is still important. And I didn't realize till recently that that was even gothic. To me, it was mystery or urban fantasy. It was on par with Susan Cooper or C.S. Lewis, modern kids uncovering a supernatural world and exploring it. Which means that when other works of the gothic genre were recommended to me, they still had a negative mental association to overcome. And even if they got past that, there was still the potential twin obstacles of dislike of its trappings or dislike of the writing style. Fast forward to 2019 and Let Them Go bypasses all of that like a ghost through a wall. It's a modern writer, with a similar empathy and politics to my own, and a writing style that engages me. It's a 21st century take on an era hundreds of years removed that isn't afraid of holding Gothic up to the light, discarding what is problematic, lifting up what is good, and yet never not feeling like the same kind of genre, at least now that I know what all the tropes are supposed to be. For example, one of the elements is of the quote-unquote virginal maiden. Young, beautiful, pure, and innocent. That doesn't apply to any of the women in this story. The closest that would come to that archetype would be maybe Amanda, but she never comes off as being unworldly. The worst that you can say about her, again, is that she is optimistic and she tries to see the best in all circumstances, all people, but that more comes from a desire to experience life as best she can and to, for her to feel good about the world and her life and to help other people feel better about their circumstances, whether it's talking with Rafe about, you know, his murky past of being a soldier and the ghosts that haunt him, or all of the work that she has to do trying to protect Rebecca from her own brain. Not because the things that Rebecca worries about aren't important, but because Amanda understands that Rebecca obsesses over them more than is healthy.
No, so, I would agree. I think that Amanda does have a remarkable talent for understanding people and speaking with them. At the start, you may have the impression that Rebecca is the more practical one of the two. Mm-hmm. And I would say that while Amanda is the more sort of artistic and poetic of the two, I think she does connect with a lot of people, but it's not something that happens all of the time. The shop owner, the neighboring shop owner, she tries a charisma role, and it's a good try, but it doesn't quite pass it. So she goes, I probably shouldn't have used the castle, not the castle fish analogy, that's Age of Ultron.
I probably shouldn't have mentioned the Remora analogy.
Everything with her, I think, is very much a case of using her talent to try and help the situation when Rebecca has been hard done by the reading of the will. She is the one who is suggesting solutions to this and things that they can do. And at the end of the book, when she writes that letter, she shows her very impressive insight in that she is able to, through no like concrete evidence, just what she is able to piece together from her observations of these two, know exactly what the situation is and come up with a situation which, although it kills her and we don't know if it would have really worked, the potential is there. So I think there is that practicality to her that she uses this insight for. And I think it's what makes the loss of her so early on such a blow, because when things are getting very fraught and you kind of need tensions between the quote unquote survivors, you know, in a sort of very Walking Dead sense of the term of how you view all these characters and butting heads, etc., she would be a huge help in that situation, but she can't because she's losing her focus. So the fact that she, even in this state, is able to write that wonderful letter at the end, which is in so many ways one of her best achievements, even if the solution she proposes can't come to be, I really do think that that letter brings some sense of closure, or if not closure, it has an effect on Rebecca in that this unresolved part of her past is now resolved.
On top of Amanda not fitting the trope cleanly, it's actually Rebecca that has the mysterious past that sometimes fits with the gothic heroine. But even that is a subversion. The mysterious past is not a result of things the characters don't know, but rather kept from us by the author himself until the most dramatic time. There is also something I want to include that I had forgotten to bring up at time of the original conversation. Alex and Sharon discussed Phantom of the Opera in a recent podcast that focuses not on the original novel by LaRue, but the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical and the movie adaptation of the same in 2004. And Sharon brings up the topic of gothic heroines, that they walk a fine line of being sympathetic even when they make bad decisions as a part of the plot. Rebecca is special in that she never really makes bad decisions. Neither does Rafe or Amanda. Making a choice that has an unhappy outcome isn't the same as acting foolishly or rashly. At the time I said to Toby that Let Them Go felt like the anti-gothic, because Rebecca constantly avoids the pitfalls of acting with too much emotion, that the story shows that it's possible to have a female character that doesn't make mistakes just to keep the story going. It's only now, after further exposure and discussion, that I can see how ignorant a conclusion that was. Never blame on the genre what is clearly just the choices or privilege of the author. Men can write with understanding of the female experience, and at the same time, part of that experience of being human is sometimes acting foolishly, or alternately, acting with complete confidence, and yet having that choice still wound you. To quote one of the best moments of Star Trek,
"It is possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. That is not a weakness. That is life."
All right, so one of the other elements is the older, foolish woman. Tell me, Toby, would you describe Aunt Cleo as foolish?
Fuck no.
Yeah, I know. I was totally teeing up a shot for you to hit out of the park. Again, not all of these things are elements in all books. I'm going off the list.
No.
That some of the books that come up again and again are The Castle of Otranto and The Romance of the Forest, both of which includes the virginal maiden and the older foolish woman. As mentioned before, Aunt Cleo is very much the crone archetype for me, which means that she is a form of the divine to me. And it doesn't reveal at first all of her wisdom and all this sort of thing, but she is always a stabilizing force, and it's clear that she pays attention to what's going on as well. So even if it's as simple as noticing how Dawson responds to her welcome to Ravenwood, she keeps her own counsel and knows very much how to control what she says or how to frame things in order to generally get the best possible result out of a situation. she is also not presented as any kind of a foil or stumbling block to our heroes of Rebecca and Amanda. She acts to try and improve the situation. She comforts Rebecca during their darkest point in the story up till that moment, as well as trying to address some of the wounds that came about even before the Barghest showed up. And when we actually get to talking about the Triple Goddess again, I will unlimber myself more fully on that score. But yeah,
I'm confident it will come back up, so don't worry, you'll have your chance.
Exactly.
But no, I do agree that I think that Aunt Cleo is very much a source of strength, even if she doesn't sort of pull Rebecca aside and impart wisdom in the sense of she doesn't have any tips that during a key moment, Rebecca sort of flashes back and hears the echoing words of Aunt Cleo. There's never a moment like that.
I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All you have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to you.
What Aunt Cleo represents, in to some extent, is an echo forward of who Rebecca can be and eventually becomes by the end of this story. She's the person who goes out and takes the shotgun and kills one of these creatures. She is able to navigate Dawson, and she is the one who instigates taking the key and locking Amanda in. So she kind of recognizes and addresses what Amanda is becoming before Rebecca does in that moment, and later on she will do that. So she really is this, she's like a version of Rebecca who is further along.
That is very well said there. Put a pin on that, because yeah, that's definitely there are many other gothic tropes that don't show up at all in Let Them Go. One of the significant aspects of Let Them Go is that it basically all happens in one night. Most of the other gothic stories that I've looked at tend to all take place within a larger span of time, even if it's just like a few days or a week. A lot of them take place over months and sometimes years. On top of it being gothic horror, it's what some people would refer to as a bottle episode. It's happening all in one place for the most part, and doesn't include a large cast of characters. Or if it does, then it's through flashbacks and very tiny moments that they're just background. They aren't actual participants in the story.
And I think that might be owing to the fact that this story's genesis was originally an idea for a new century film that could feasibly be filmed, and having a small cast would work very well for that. And sorry, there's a very loud motorbike passing by, but going back to my point.
You should have said it was the ghost. Yeah. Come on, man, we've got a theme going on here.
Well, everyone, all our friends on Centrum listening to this will say, what the hell's a motorbike? I love some of the images that Alex recently put up with Sharon posing for the front cover, because it really does make me feel like it is a possibility that somewhere down the line, if someone in this circle of New Century fandom happens to come into possession of a manor house, maybe we could work something out and put a film together.
The only other aspects that I wanted to address with traditional gothic fiction in particular are the hero and the tyrant slash villain in this particular case.
There's a tyrant in this story?
Well, see, that's the thing, is that, again, this is one of the potential tropes that gets flipped here. I don't necessarily feel that Dawson is a tyrant or a villain in the traditional sense. He is a threat to Amanda and Rebecca and to Cleo because of his weakness and fear and inability to cope with the situation. But he's not quote-unquote evil. He doesn't have malice about him when Rebecca has to deal with him by placating him and assuaging his fear when he's human, or by finally bringing an end to him as soon as he's transformed, it's a matter of fact, like, he is a danger, but not in the same way that Dracula is the villain of his own story. Other traditional Gothic villains would include Edward Hyde or Dorian Gray, a Byronic hero like Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights, or simply an antagonist like Mrs. Havisham from Great Expectations.
Dawson isn't willing these events to happen. You know, everything that happens in Dracula isn't like Dracula going, oh, what a crazy happenstance, all these people tend to have their necks bitten, how did that happen? And that's why, as bad as it gets and as frustrated as you can be with him, you never really see him as, God, I just wish he was dead. Like, to a certain extent, it's difficult because there's one Doctor Who episode from the David Tennant era, which is when they're on this, like, Titanic, this sort of alien space Titanic. And it's one of those episodes where it has a sort of cast of characters who, you know, they're slowly going to be whittled down, and one of them's this just the worst, and he's so selfish, and you're waiting for him to go. And by the end of the episode, most of the rest of the cast is gone, but he is still there. And he actually reflects, even though he's thanking the Doctor, he says, because of how circumstances played out, I've actually ended up being even wealthier. And you go, like, well, that's great, I'm so glad you're here. But then another character says that he's not the sort of person you would have wanted to make it through this, but if we could actually make that decision, wouldn't that make us so much worse than we are? And it's the point that just because these people can be colossal dicks, that doesn't mean that they deserve to die. They aren't, like, we shouldn't be counting down the seconds to their death. And even by the end of it, when Rebecca is caving his skull in, when he is halfway through the door, it's like she does it repeatedly, and there's a certain amount of tension being relieved, but it doesn't feel like something that we should revel in necessarily. It's just, you're happy that she has managed to not die, and this is a positive step forward, but Dawson's death is not a little victory moment. It's sad.
That's an important thing to point out. I will say that I reacted very strongly to Dawson. Just because he's not malicious or evil doesn't mean that I wasn't afraid of him as being someone that would attempt to carry out his will, which was not for the good of everybody there. Not necessarily a coward like Benny in The Mummy. He is the kind of person that I worry would come up frequently in abusive relationships, I guess you could say.
Which is
very much like you tend to view anybody that would physically or emotionally abuse anyone else, you tend to think of them as a villain. But because his circumstance is really only limited to this one moment when everybody's lives are in danger from an unexplainable supernatural menace, we don't necessarily see enough of what he's like under other circumstances. Listening to this during the edit, I would add that it is a truism that who we are is most keenly seen when we are under pressure. And that holds whether we are talking about Dawson's actions in the book, or my own response to recapping them, in which I admit that I wanted to strangle him. That's my fear at work. But because it's apropos and we've already had him once on this podcast, let me invoke the words of a wise sage.
Many that live deserve death. Some that die deserve life. Can you give it to them, Frodo?
Anyway, the other question to then ask is, are the Barghest villains? And the answer there is generally no, because their motivations aren't one of conscience or malice. They are looking to feed. But having thought about it, one of the things that occurs to me is Dawson himself points out, we should have some time. They've fed well. No reason they should be coming to feed on us with any kind of haste or anything like that. And honestly, from that standpoint, that was one of the aspects of it that makes you question, are they simply a beast? Or is there something inside them that makes them more dangerous? Because if they're predators, why wouldn't they go off and rest, make a nest, do some of the things that pure animals would do? But no, they're sticking around, also not waiting for their prey to come out into the open. They're actively going into a space that they wouldn't necessarily understand in their state. Ambush predators tend to work in places, areas that where they can use aspects of the environment to their advantage so that they can hunt and bring down prey with the least amount of effort. You know, I've heard them say that things like mountain lions and such won't necessarily attack humans because they won't be confident of their ability to take a human down. But again and again, the Barghest go out of their way to do things like break down doors or come in through windows, specifically to try and whittle our cast of characters down to zero, which makes one think, oh, no, these are coming for our people, and merely feeding is not going to save them from a horrible end like all of the others. Except for right at the end, where Barghest Amanda and Rebecca are facing off against each other, and Amanda does not attack. The Barghest wearing her face does not attack, and we never find out why. We don't necessarily know if the Barghest was waiting for Rebecca to do something, because we do know that they can dodge and potentially get out of the way, good at reading body language or other. Remember how many times the Barghest managed to dodge a shot from Rafe trying to hit them or from Cleo trying to hit them. We will never know what was in the Barghest's head, and it brings everything else into question about what exactly the Barghest are. Are they animals? Are they a malevolent force? We don't know. A lot of you longtime fans know that not only have other books revealed more instances of complexity, but also the Wendigo's origin. And not long after this episode was recorded, an entire book was announced just titled Wendigos. I don't think it's likely this means you will ever see inside Amanda Barghest's head, though. As often happens in horror fiction, the monster works better the less you explain. Just finally, traditional gothic, we have, of course, the hero. Rafe encapsulates a lot of the aspects that qualifies the gothic hero in terms of being virtuous and courageous and self-sacrificing. He also has several other good aspects to him that are perhaps outside of the expectation for men of that era. The thing about all of this is that most of the times in these kinds of stories, the hero is, you know, survives until the end, because obviously the virginal maiden has to end up with the hero because that's how these things go. As far as this story goes, no, Rafe is out of the story before it's even halfway over.
The only role he has after that is as a component of Rebecca's heroine's journey.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, very subverted trope there. In that the hero barely gets a chance to establish himself before he is no longer part of the picture.
Completely. And it leads to two observations. One, I think that these subversions of things that you expect, these traditional story structures, all add to what I believe Let Them Go represents, which is the disintegration of old structures. Mm. It is absolutely about everything that is familiar falling apart, and then once it has done, you leave the old building, the old manor house, to go out into a wide world which is completely open and frightening, but the main character has the tools, the resources that she needs to get started, and she becomes a force of nature. That's a conversation for another time.
Toby is very cleverly referring to the song by Gavin Dunn that Alex used as the coda to the Let Them Go audio drama, which I will not include in the podcast, but will post a link to the music video on YouTube.
The other observation is that we mentioned a few episodes back that the shotgun gains this significance, partly because it becomes the last gift that Cleo gave to Rebecca before she died, and then Dawson seizing it. So you may remember that conversation. But it occurred to me that I think that the hero, in the sort of quote unquote general sense of how we view as the main character who's making most of the decisions and propelling most of the action of this story, changes hands several times throughout it. And it's almost at the same frequency at which the shotgun is changing hands. It goes to Rafe because he is trying to do what he can. He doesn't see himself as a hero. He is just doing the necessary thing, just like he did in the war. And he goes out and he looks every bit the traditional sense of the hero that we are familiar with. And it doesn't pan out. And then when Aunt Cleo picks up the shotgun and uses it with success, Rebecca, through the narrator's words, uses the specific term that Aunt Cleo was her hero. And then when she's beset upon, her status as hero is short-lived. And then when it's just the two of them, Dawson wants to seize control. So what does he do? He takes the shotgun, this item of what the hero of the story is trying to take it up to fight against the monsters of the night, and he's not doing a particularly great job of it. When Rebecca manages to take the shotgun back, she becomes the last remaining character, the hero of the rest of the story, but she's not comfortable with it. She's not familiar with it. And by that, I don't mean to suggest that she's not suited to the role of hero. She bloody well is, but it's something where, because there were so many people that she saw as deserving of that role, whether it was Aunt Cleo or Rafe, it just feels like the fact that this has passed hands so many times means that once it gets to her, she doesn't believe in herself to be able to use it. She finally uses it to take down Elsie, I think is the name of that servant who was the other Varghast. She has completed her journey to securing the power to sort of take control and be the hero.
I agree overall with what Toby said here. But I would add that while Rebecca does have to grow into being her own hero, she is always the protagonist. From the very first moment we see her, she is using her agency to make her own situation better with regard to Havisham's. It's important to specify, because based on some of the other examples mentioned, Gothic literature is rife with protagonists that are anti-heroes or outright villains. So, all right, you've still got three things on our plate here. Let us dive further into the female Gothic. Now, this is something I'd never heard of before until, like, actually looking up on Wikipedia. I was like, oh, what is Gothic fiction? What are these elements? All the such like. It is apparently a subgenre or modified genre of traditional male Gothic. The female Gothic is more than just Gothic literature written by women, although, given that it was a particular touchstone of second-wave feminism and literary critique, the very existence of female voices in the genre allowed the feminine experience to be explored in ways the male authors of the time would likely never approach. They are most often a commentary on male power structures, violence, and predatory sexuality, as well as the centering of feminine social or sexual desires. Male authors might delve deeply into corrupt men as well, but would tend almost exclusively to the bad apple fallacy, that the fault of flawed men or outright villains is an aberration, and not that a social structure that gives men more power over women might have a hand in creating and supporting them. Male authors would also be unlikely to suggest such a structure needs to be torn down, because that then lessens the importance of their virtuous male protagonists. Now, separate from all of that, another element of the female Gothic is something called the supernatural explained. In brief, if there appear to be supernatural elements in the story that contribute to the plot's mystery or drama or protagonist's journey, the author will go out of their way to dispel the fear that such things might cause by explaining them away with rationality. Now, we've talked a lot about this up and down. Would you say that within the text of Let Them Go, is the supernatural explained?
So I have a like actual sort of personal story that connects to this, which is it's one of the things that I do feel a little regretful of, which is that in one of the write-ups of one of the chapters of Let Them Go, I made a sort of remark on one of the epilogues, which we've mentioned, those little extra tidbits that are left at the end of some of the chapters that kind of flesh out the world. And it is a segment which may or may not be on certain versions of the story. If you get the full audiobook, it probably isn't there. But it mentions that in the years after the events of this story, people would still hear voices on the spot where Ravenwood is, or something to that effect. And I remarked that I think, oh, well, that, I forget my exact wording, but I think it was something to the effect of, this is something which kind of softly confirms that there is something more supernatural at play. And afterwards, I heard Alex talking about how he confided in me that he didn't really want to confirm or deconfirm anything. So part of what I had written did feed back into the way he framed things. And so I feel very guilty about that, because I think that I chose my words poorly, and I hope that that didn't cause him to sort of make a change to something that he wanted to do. But at the same time, I think that if I can remedy that by answering your question, there are different levels of the supernatural. And even at its most intense, it is left ambiguous, because at the start of the story, there is a level of reality as the characters know it. It's the undisrupted world before Egyptian rabies starts to spread. The prospect of opening up this shop and connecting it with the shop next door. Once they wrap up this business, they want to get back to their life as they knew it. That is reality. And then you have the emergence of the Barghest. And if you are revisiting the story, or you are someone who has experienced this story after other New Century books, you know that the Barghest, or the Wendigo, are very much a real thing. They are in the world of this narrative and this series, they are part of the reality. They have a real and concrete effect on the world, but to the people.
And by this he means the characters in the story.
This is something new. It is, to all intents and purposes, supernatural to them. It defies explanation, as several chapters, particularly Hypothesis, kind of show. It's these characters struggle to really identify what this thing is. It's only Amanda who has an interest in the supernatural in that coach ride up to Ravenwood that she discussed this. She is able to have the imagination to suggest what this thing is. So the Barghest is something that is very real and concrete, but it is very much a new thing that creates this sort of supernatural effect. So that supernatural aspect of the story is explained. It is said, this is what it is. But at the same time, it doesn't fully explain it. So it is this nice, comfortable middle space that it occupies, where everything's ambiguous. And then you get to near the end of the story, where not only do you have the ghosts which haunt Rebecca, but you also have the space beneath the basement, that sub-basement or whatever the area is in the vaults that never goes explored in this narrative. There are hidden secrets that even we, the sort of very well-informed audience, don't fully understand what is at play here. So are those spirits that Rebecca comes to see in that penultimate chapter, is she actually seeing ghosts, or is this just representative of the inner turmoil she's experiencing? And I think that what I want to say now, just going back to the beginning of this lengthy answer to your question is that I don't want to ever treat my analysis or our analysis of these stories as a sort of go down the road of those YouTube videos you see which say, here's the end of this horror movie explained, multiple exclamation marks, which are trying to piece together exactly what is going so that you can say categorically, this is what happened. That is not really what the ending of Let Them Go is about. Whatever is going on at the end, the point is that there is something ambiguous at work here. It is the next level of supernatural down from the Barghest. At the very least, we have a name for it. We are able to gain some level of understanding of it. We don't understand what is at play with those, in quotation marks, ghosts in that chapter.
I excised a bunch of conversation we had at the time here because it was basically rediscussing a lot of things we covered in previous episodes, and I want to acknowledge the reason why I brought up the topic of the female Gothic to begin with. While Alex is the writer of this novel, it is informed by the contributions of both his own feminist mindset and the thoughts of his wife Sharon, whose understanding of psychology and sociology is impressive. Let Them Go does thoroughly address ideas and experiences that only female Gothic authors back in the day would have tried to. But Alex and Sharon also defy this label through its embrace of the supernatural and its mysteries. As Toby said, some things our heroes gain a plausible explanation for, but the theory cannot be confirmed, nor does it dispel the fear entirely. The danger is still real. And other things are left as an exercise to the reader, because there are multiple potential explanations, and none will ever likely be confirmed. This is why the William Butler Yeats poem was invoked at the beginning. The rational alone will not save you. This podcast is titled Through the Wind Door, which both hints at something supernatural that new readers have not seen, and also invokes the looking glass world of Lewis Carroll. There are more things in heaven, earth, and this series than are dreamt of in your philosophies. Some magic and monsters will be explained, and some never will be. And for now, we are at an end attempting to do so. But there's some funny bits at the end, so I will take us back to the tail end of that discussion now.
My point is that from the female Gothic standpoint, it doesn't do the Scooby-Doo thing where it was Old Man Withers and all that sort of thing.
I would have gotten away with it too if it hadn't been for you meddling Barghest.
Oh, that would be interesting. If I don't know if that's a thing that ever
Scooby-Doo
came up.
Barghest.
Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo.
The Scooby snacks were people all along. I feel like that's something they might have tried eventually, because old Scooby-Doo was always the monster of someone in a hood, or in a mask, rather. And new Scooby-Doo might have had more of a, you know, sometimes the supernatural is actually there, and it's not just someone manipulating real estate or anything like that. But
You know what? In this story, the will is right there. They could have like tied that into like Dawson using the Barghest as some way to manipulate the situation. Coming in with the hot takes right now is alternate reading. We're going to see in several like books down the line that Dawson is really still alive, pulling the strings behind everything.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Anyway,
so,
after I yanked us way off track, come on, Greg, you're the responsible one of us, so I will leave you to, I'll let you take the lead again. My bad.
So wait a second. Are you saying that I'm the Rebecca and you're the Amanda here?
So, you gonna let me, leave me on the treetop? Because that would be... Please don't draw the shotgun. I don't think I would be fast enough to act on that.
No, I. What would I do without you? We need two voices in here to play off each other. This is not the end of our final discussion of Let Them Go. Even with using my editing shears liberally, the total content was already adding up to almost 2 hours of material, and one of the first pieces of advice Alex gave me was to respect my listeners' time
and try to keep things as concise as possible. On top of that, I had more things than expected to wrangle at work this week, and it was too hot to edit at home, so I'm dividing this episode into two parts, and part two will come out the following Monday. So to cap off this episode, let me share another piece of music that is a favorite of mine, this time from a female artist, that I feel invokes Rebecca at the end of her story. Off her album, This Is Acting, I give you Sia, and singing about a bird set free.
Clipped wings, I was a broken thing, had a voice but I could not sing it.